I have indicated what I think, what we think, that the Americans evidently are suffering from overcommitment. They do not want anymore to play the role of a world policeman all around the world. They want a certain relief in their commitments in Europe.
If you had your choice between America playing policeman to the world or solving its domestic problems more rapidly, which would you take?
Well, naturally, I'm concerned about myself and prices. I think we probably have to do a certain amount of policing for the world, but not as much as maybe we have in the past or thought we had to. We can only spread ourselves so thin.
It seems to me that the time has come also to perhaps consider how extensive our commitments are and find ways in which we might cut back on those commitments. I'm not suggesting a policy of isolation, far be it. I think we're part of the world, and we're part of the family of nations. We can't escape that.
I am interested in me and my family first, and what you know goes for this country is the best. And I'm not really that much involved with the foreign countries. It's fine to help them, but I can't see breaking our back to do it.
So it looks like most of our people would agree with Herr Franz Josef Strauss of the CDU-CSU Coalition of West Germany. He's the head of the Christian Socialist Union of Bavaria and a former defense minister, and after that a finance minister of the West German government. And you can't really disagree with the people in the United States who say they are concerned about their children, their family, the food on their plates and the clothing on their backs first. But by the same token, you can't either take too much exception to people inside the European Economic Community, like laborers in France and Germany and Belgium, the Netherlands, and even in Britain, who say and feel the same things. The trouble is that with everybody putting self and selfish national interests first, with a growing wave of nationalism very evident in Europe, Asia, Latin America, and for that matter around the world, and at the same time, a growing trend toward pulling back to isolationism inside the United States, it means that the geopolitical situation between nations and their foreign policies cannot remain very friendly for very much longer. I want to talk about isolationism, about three aspects of what is happening inside the United States in the community of nations and what most people feel about it, and perhaps some things that may happen in the future that we don't want to happen, but we seem unable to avoid. First, inside the United States, there is evident a mood of isolationism. Now, I don't mean that in the classic sense of the term, back like in the 1920s, the early 1930s, and following in the wake of a disastrous economic collapse back then and pre-World War II, a political term of isolationism. It isn't quite that harsh today or quite that negative. It's a highly subjective term, and primarily it has to do with people turning inward in the sense of being weary of the billions they read about going in for foreign aid and supporting other countries who rarely, if ever, support the United States when it comes to votes in the United Nations or in other ways. A turning inward to where the United States has simply had to become far more aware, and painfully so, of our own domestic problems, not the least of which has been Watergate of late. Secondly, a lack of confidence in the United States abroad. That's what we're going to talk about this time. And that follows because of the United States' pullback in many strategic areas of the world. And third, the resultant dramatic change in foreign policies, the shifting climates of the geopolitical picture, and what is going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years as a direct result in such large power blocks as the growing European Economic Community we've been taking a look at in this past series, and also the rising might of the supergiant of Japan, along with, of course, the constant threat of the Soviet Union and a nuclear-armed Red China. In the aftermath of World War II, after we had fought the world's most costly and devastating war against German and Japanese expansionism, the United States found itself in the saddle as the world's strongest power. We didn't want it, it's just what happened. America, challenged by Soviet expansionism, took on the immense responsibility of being world policeman, champion of the cause to make the world safe for democracy. America poured out $14 billion in Marshall Plan aid between 1948 and 1952. To date, it has lavished out around $150 billion in foreign aid, much of which, of course, though, has been tied to American purchases abroad. Bases all over the world became outposts for America's legions. The United States obligated itself to come to the military and economic aid of over 40 nations in 8 major alliances and with 20 other countries in lesser-known military arrangements. But by the time of the 1970s, under the pressure of massive external and internal problems, the concept of America's role as world policeman began to become dramatically altered. We had had our nose bloodied and our shins barked, and that's a very polite term for saying that we had been deeply afflicted with a national wound in Korea. We didn't learn any lessons in Korea, either from fighting a land war in the periphery of Asia, or from fighting a limited war for limited political or geopolitical objectives, instead of pulling out all stops and fighting a war against the enemy which was the very embodiment of all evil for total stakes. Now, Americans had proved in World War II that they could fight that kind of a war and do an awfully good job of it. Americans were said to be some of the best soldiers the world had ever seen, especially when given the kind of massive air cover and artillery and mechanized support they had in those classic battles as Patton's and Mark Clark's and other generals' armies went ravaging across France and Europe at the conclusion of World War II. We should have learned a lesson in Asia. We were warned against it by General Stilwell and a lot of others. But during that day, the pragmatists under Harry Truman's government decided that the communist Chinese would not respond, and even General MacArthur felt they would not, but his miscalculation was, when he told Mr. Truman this, out in the Atlantic at a conference they had, that he felt that we could always threaten the communist Chinese with the interdiction of American atomic or nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons which we had. What General Douglas MacArthur didn't seem to know was that Harry Truman was not going to allow him to use limited tactical nuclear weapons under any circumstances. We didn't learn our lesson at Pork Chop and Bloody Ridge and Bunker Hill. And so we went on into an agonizing, traumatic, 10 years long, devastating war in Vietnam. Vietnam catalyzed and polarized many of the very deeply disturbing and terribly eroding social issues inside the United States. It did more to divide this country than perhaps any single event in all of our history from the time of the Civil War. We began to witness in the 60s this protracted racial struggle. All of the domestic crises, whether you're talking about prices or wages or pollution or the interurban crises or traffic or whether you're talking certainly about racism and drug addiction and the rise in crime, they seem to become far more heightened and far more catalyzed during the protracted struggle in Vietnam. So while on the one hand we had a war seemingly being waged by government leaders alone who were concerned with maintaining America's status as a world power, people at home, sick to death, sick right down to the inside of their guts with that war in Vietnam, were turning and most of the time forcibly so, being forced into turning into domestic crises because the domestic crises were those that were afflicting them, their children, their family, or were happening on their own front yard. And so, really, Vietnam was a major turning point in American history. It changed us very significantly, and perhaps it'll take us quite a long period of time to really know just how seriously Vietnam did bloody the United States and how deeply it has afflicted the very moral fiber of our country.
The mighty Roman Empire had everything. Plenty of leisure time. Their own new morality. Enormous military might. The religion of their choice. Political freedom. What went wrong? Read The Modern Romans, a 93-page lesson of history ignored. For your free copy of The Modern Romans, write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. the modern Romans asks, can we afford the grandeur of Rome?
Now, I hope you'll write for that booklet. If I could, I'd just toss you one right there where you're sitting, right through the window of this television medium. Unfortunately, we haven't got quite to that point yet where television's that far advanced. If it were, I'd just hand you your free copy right now, and you wouldn't even need to send your name, which would make it a lot easier on many people. Taking a look at another side of the coin, Americans may want to shed many of their burdens and responsibilities, of which most Americans, when they're shopping for the high-priced meat, dairy products, of course, practically everything in foods, even vegetables these days, and citrus and the like, they're almost totally unconcerned. They don't even really know in figures of billions what foreign aid, foreign commitments, U.S. troops stationed abroad in Korea, as well as in Vietnam, in the periphery of Southeast Asia, and inside Europe. They don't really know what those figures are, what the massive costs are. Maybe to boil it down, you could put it this way. You have some idea of what fuel costs you, of course. But do you have any idea what it costs to keep a jet aircraft the size of a KC-135, which is a military prototype of the 707 jet, in the air? Those things burn thousands upon thousands of pounds of fuel per hour. And that fuel sometimes costs you around 50 cents and more a gallon, depending upon the kind of fuel and where you are, of course. It can go up or it can go down. If we could just imagine what it costs an aircraft carrier, for example, with about 3,000 men aboard and maybe three squadrons of aircraft, with all of them operating, all of those salaries, all of the fuel, if it's not a nuclear carrier, and so on, to keep going. When you talk about a vast fleet at sea, and hundreds of thousands of military men and all of the support equipment that it takes to maintain an army abroad. There is a real parallel and an overlapping of what happened to those Roman legions as ancient Rome sought through military might to keep an empire tranquil and peaceful and to keep it together. Pax Romana, the peace that Rome was going to give to the rest of the world. Well, the United States foreign relations are very, very complex and very involved. And from one country to another, they can differ very vastly because they're completely different relationships and different animosities. But our foreign relations are much like that of the analogy of a person that has a heart condition who may have to wear a pacemaker. No matter how much the patient resents it, that pacemaker is in there and he's stuck with it. He's either got to pay attention to it and hope it keeps him going, or not. And the United States is in a position now where abroad, especially with regard to foreign aid, maintaining our commitments militarily, as well as certain preferential trade agreements and the like, reciprocity in trade, quotas, whatnot, at the same time, we have to purchase oil abroad. We have to purchase some things abroad we don't need. We're selling things abroad we can better use at home, especially agricultural and farm products, for example, wheat and the like, and now we find ourselves with shortages. Yet, politically, we dare not stem that massive flow of agricultural products to other countries because we're in competition with some of our friendly allies, and we simply have to keep it going. So we're cursed if we do, and we're cursed if we don't. What we don't seem to know in this country is that our own disarray economically, our own financial disorder, has brought about resultant hard feelings because of certain financial disorder abroad. And that our own devaluation, while we look upon it as a threat to the dollar and our own buying power and rising prices eventually, all of which is true, has temporarily, though, hurt our relationships with countries where we have a great volume of trade, far more than it has hurt the United States domestically. It takes a long time for it to catch up with us and hurt us domestically. So, our own rising economic weaknesses, inflation, devaluation, balance of payments, trade conflicts, and the like, is at the heart of a great deal of the miscontent and rising nationalism becoming more and more evident all the time abroad. So this rising nationalism that rears its ugly head every now and then in the form of a military dictatorship regime, such as the one recently voted in for at least 7 years and called a republic in Greece, that which is happening rather inexplicably, in a sense, in Central and South America right now. For example, Juan Perón, where the leftists as well as the rightists are solidly behind the return of a strong man to power in one of the very big nations and powerful nations of Latin, or I should say now of South America, which is, of course, Buenos Aires, Rio de Janeiro, I shouldn't say Rio, but Buenos Aires, the capital of Argentina, where I have been very recently, and in talking to people there, once again familiarizing myself with the ebb and the flow of life in some of the big Central South American capitals. And I'm always amazed when I go to Central South America with a fantastic amount of anti-American sentiment. It is there and it is evident. It's everywhere. continually on trips in Central and South America in the past. I've noticed it. And you can't avoid it. You can't escape it. You know, maybe you don't realize it, but I have been asked this kind of a way-out question by one person who was in the employ of an American company, actually the Ford company, and this was in a Central American country some years ago. He wanted to know to what extent the American Fruit Company really was the American government. Now, many of you may never have even heard of the American Fruit Company. Little do we seem to realize that some companies such as this, operating vessels, buying the millions of tons of bananas and of all kinds of tropical fruit, and certainly the coffee dollars community of Brazil, to what degree these people, with their meager salaries, resent the giant to the north. Textbooks in Latin America, even in Mexico, always speak of the colossus to the north. We're called that in Central and South America. There's a term, it is a disrespectful or despective term in the Spanish language. It goes like this. It's called riquisillos, and it means filthy rich, the dirty rich. And that term is used very freely of Yankees in the United States by our Latin American neighbors. They say, you know, that all the Yankees are riquisillos, but they feel that we have become rich on the blood, the sweat, and the tears, and the national raw materials and goods of those countries, and that we have exploited those countries. This is true in countries all over the world to a greater or a lesser degree. A rising flow of nationalism even inside Japan. So wherever you go around the world these days, Americans, as they travel abroad, will find at least two things increasingly true. One is that their dollars go nowhere near so far, that they can buy fewer yen, fewer Deutschmarks or French or Swiss francs these days with their dollars. And secondly, they're going to find here and there, if they're willing to get off the beaten path of just the tourist traps and the honky-tonks exclusively for Americans, they're going to find outright hostility. Now already, in the higher echelon of parlays for trade and for various agreements that are going on between the United States and other countries, whether it is cultural exchanges or whatever level of sub-governmental levels, you will find a great deal more antagonism than in the past. And as a matter of fact, you would begin to think as you listen to some of these meetings and hear what comes out of them, that even some of our trading partners, and especially the European Economic Community of the European Union, begin to sound more like antagonists and enemies than they do friends and allies. United States economic weakness is what is behind all of this, and the Europeans blame us for that. They say they are not guilty. Many Americans who maybe don't know any better and are sincerely concerned about rising prices and spiraling inflation are simply saying, and this is true American isolationism, let's say, but not in its classic form, why should we support those Europeans? They say, we should be owed a debt of gratitude, they say. They say, we built them up from nothing after World War II. They should be giving to us. Well, this is a very simplistic way of looking at it. That is not the way families inside the European Economic Community who are paying $3 and $4 a pound for beef and $1.50 for a pound of butter look at it. They look at it with the same vigor and the same kind of a nationalistic, I am going to look out for me and my family and my job first, that you see Americans in their supermarkets as they're frustrated and distraught because of rising prices. So in short, many Europeans argue that the United States is selfishly asking other nations to solve problems that are of our own private making.
The last Apollo flight lands on the moon while religious war rages in Northern Ireland. Politicians search for peace while pollution engulfs our planet. The gross national product of the United States exceeds $1 trillion, while some 15,000 starve to death worldwide every day. In this age of paradox unparalleled, where can you turn for understanding? There is a source that answers the frightening questions of the 20th century. It's called The Plain Truth. This magazine of understanding reveals the meaning behind today's world news and shows you the good news beyond. The Plain Truth is full color, 52 pages, totally free of charge in the public interest. Today, more than ever before, you need The Plain Truth. For a free subscription, write Ambassador College, Box 111, Pasadena, California. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, BC.
The seeming eagerness of the United States to pull back and withdraw from any worldwide posts and responsibilities, especially in the light of our economic and social difficulties at this present time, is creating a great deal of lack of confidence among our own allies. Now, let's just take a few of the classic cases in point where we can see the cursed if you do, cursed if you don't aspects of this very delicate and very difficult situation. We are beginning to pull back. That is our posture now. We're sick and tired, sick to death of involvement in brushfire type wars abroad. So let's take a look at the Asian area. Here is Japan, a tiny island country. A country that nevertheless is one of the true supergiants of this modern age. It's reality now. No matter what we think about World War II and what we think about Japanese people in general, you better awaken to the fact that Japan is here to stay, that she is a giant economic and trading power in the world. But Japan is an island country with practically none of the resources, the raw materials that must keep her entire industry going. Japanese people are concerned about Japanese people. Japanese workers about their wives and wives about their children. They are beginning to enjoy now a tremendous heightened standard of living above that which they have ever known in all of their history. But they've got unions and they've got strikes and they've got ultra-leftists and dissidents and they've got ultra-rightists and new religions springing up like Soka Gakkai, a kind of a new nationalism. They've got terrible, gross pollution problems, mounting crime, education in ferment and turmoil, and they've got geopolitical problems too. Because you see, Japan's lifeline is stretched far thinner and therefore is far more vulnerable than even is ours. Japan must import practically all of her raw materials, many of those coming from the United States. And just like a bizarre repetition of some of those things that happened prior to World War II, only recently the United States decided to sharply restrict some of the scrap iron we were sending to Japan, and Japan desperately needs huge shipments of American scrap iron to feed her own steel mills over there for the production of this never-ending stream of commodities that go like an avalanche of trade to all parts of the world, but principally right back into the United States. So Japan finds herself in this situation. The vital sea lanes from Japan down through former Indonesia and, through the Straits of Malacca, past Singapore, on up into Kuwait, Abu Dhabi, Bahrain, the Persian Gulf, the oil-rich sheikdoms there, are left vulnerable to Red Chinese or Soviet threat if the United States is no longer a policeman for that area. It could also be argued, and has been in the Diet in Japan, that with the return of Okinawa, Japan once more has an outlying island possession of some consequence. It's easily arguable, though unpalatable to the Japanese populace, that defense spending has to rise proportionate to Japan's need to control vital sea lanes, to protect her own sources of raw materials, as well as her own areas of trade, to protect, a tremendous, big, and growing merchant marine that Japan has, which is the largest on the face of the earth today. So Japan has many viable reasons why she needs to expand in a military area. Japan could become very easily and very quickly a nuclear power. As the United States pulls back, that begins to create a vacuum, and Japan is going to move in. I have said for years, and I will repeat very likely for years to come as it becomes reality, that in the event of any power vacuum in the Asian area, Japan, not China, is going to move in to fill up that power vacuum. You can put that down in your memory book and remember where you heard it, maybe. The Soviet Union, on the other hand, with the absence of American troops on European soil and a hesitancy on the part of the American population to get involved, a cutback in defense spending, reduction in our space program and the like, has resulted in somewhat the same situation vis-a-vis the Middle East and the Mediterranean area. In the Middle East, for example, we have the cursed if you do and cursed if you don't situation between Israel and the Arab allies. The Arab countries we want good relations with because of our need for Arab or Arabian oil. On the other hand, they have toyed with the idea of curtailing that oil because of American support of Israel. And there again, there you are. Cursed if we do, and cursed if we don't. We don't want to maintain strong fleets abroad because of the fantastic costs. and the idea of pulling back from a draft situation into an all-professional Navy, Marine Corps, and Army. And so as we pull back and we cut down U.S. fleet units, and we try to stylize, and we try to get these vessels nuclear-powered and less of them and this and that, the Soviet Union begins to move in that particular area. This makes Europe very nervous because European powers see the Mediterranean area as the soft underbelly of Europe. They, like Japan, have vital trade areas and vital sources for raw materials, especially oil, that flow from those Arab and North African oil states. The growing might of the Soviet Union in the Mediterranean area is going to cause a complete reorganization of the military posture of all of Europe. You can put that down in your memory book and remember where you heard it, because it's going to happen. And as the United States then turns inward in this growing wave of isolationism, again, not in the classic sense, but perhaps a new 1970s sense of isolationism, it's going to result in a vacuum being created in Asia, in Central and South America, in the Mediterranean area, and the Indian Ocean. And other powers are going to move in to fill up those vacuums. But next, it's going to result in distrust and hostility from some of our allies and our friends. And that's going to result in growing military might and a complete different posture as a result of that growing military might in Europe and Japan as well as elsewhere. Now today there are five major powers where you used to think of three. They are the United States, the Soviet Union, Red China, nuclear armed, the European Economic Community, and Japan. Those are the five big powers of this modern age, and those are the big powers that are going to be jostling for position on the world geopolitical scene in the next very few months. The United States, on the one hand, can't afford to keep turning inward. And yet, because of our crushing economic, social, racial, crime, weather, pollution, and economic problems, which I said once, because of all of these things, we can't help but turn inward. We've just about got to, because it seems our own home is in such disorder. We've got to do a little bit of housekeeping and house cleaning at home. But as we do so, it means pulling back from abroad, losing friends, losing prestige, losing the pride in our power. And some of those friends are turning into rather skeptical friends, and some of them into bitter and hostile enemies. If you want to keep abreast of what is happening, you need to get your name on the mailing list of this unique magazine that fills an absolute void that would be there if this magazine didn't exist. And it's called The Plain Truth. Every single month, articles just like this telecast and like the radio program you're hearing on the soundtrack of this television tape will be dealing with energy crises, with the racial crises, mounting crime, the problems of the United States as they are viewed in the light of Bible prophecy, and a pretty good strong statement about where we go from here, what your future is going to be like. Be sure to write for the current number of the Plain Truth magazine and also that booklet called The Modern Romans. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong. See you then.
You have seen Garner Ted Armstrong. Send your letters to Ambassador College, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Or Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, BC.